Station number 11944.
Judge Jaland, Reel 4. You were telling me about the first dead Durham you saw.
Yes. Well, he didn't affect me one way or the other. We moved on, and my platoon was given the job of clearing a wood. We went into this wood. Spirits were still very high. We were on the move again. And in due course, we came across a caravan in a clearing, a German caravan. And we surrounded it and waited for people to appear, but nobody came, and investigated and found it was empty. And had a quick look round. It was obviously a command vehicle of some kind. Maps and so on round about. And there was a German officer's cap, peak cap, on the table. And I noticed there was an ashtray with a cigarette in it, which was still smoking. And we realised then that we were not very far away from our enemy, and we moved on. It was at the end of that wood, when getting over the fence, that I caused this disturbance by jumping down and thereby discharging my Sten gun, which was on my shoulder, and the bullet drilled a hole in the rim of my tin hat. It deafened me for ages in that left ear. The shot ringing out caused not a little concern to everybody round about, who thought the shooting was starting. And it was as a result of that incident that I never carried a Sten gun again, because it was too dangerous, and I switched to a rifle. We moved up from that. Was in that wood. That,
can you tell me what sort of wood it was? What its characteristics were?
Well, I think it was open. It wasn't a thick, undergrowthy wood. You could walk between the trees. It was, I think, a sort of pine wood thing, and you spread out, possibly Mediterranean pines, I don't know. But that sort of thing. And you could see for a certain distance.
And the enemy were not in it any longer, right?
Well, they weren't there, but, I mean, they'd just gone.
They'd withdrawn in front of you.
Yes, they'd gone, moved back, but they must have heard us coming, to leave as they did, and the officer to leave his hat behind. Anyway, just after that, very shortly after that, I was subjected to my first mortar attack from the enemy. They used one of these Minenwaffe, the moaning minis. The bombs, of course, mortar bombs, were all going off in the trees above us. I'd never heard anything like it in my life. This honking and then the bang, bang, bang all round. And everybody was scuttling out of the way, and there was no cover at all, but I don't remember any casualties. I don't know if they weren't near enough or whatever it was, but obviously the signal had been given that we were there, and the Germans were dealing with it. But they only fired for a comparatively short time. I don't know whether it's one burst or two bursts of however many cylinders they've got. But that was my first experience of mortar fire, which I didn't enjoy. We then moved on to the outskirts of Catania, and we were told to take up a position on the road. I think it was a sort of ring road outside the town, on the south of the town. Yes, the south of the town. And we were told that some priests, mobile guns, and tracked field guns, were coming up to support us, and we must not let them get onto the out of the road they were on and onto this ring road. We must stop them. By this time, it was, I suppose, middle of the afternoon. We've been going some time. And the men were tired, so we all settled down in the field with our backs to the wall on the road, the roadside. Sat down there, and I put a sentry up, private soldier, to watch out for the priests. And we were having a smoke, talk, and so on. We're all very excited. And in due course, we heard the tracks coming. And it sounded really, it got to the stage, they were so near, we thought there were Moors coming through the wall. And in the end, I got up to have a look, because no warning had been given by this private soldier to me that they were there, or didn't do anything to stop them coming. And I was just in time to pull him back off the wall and behind the wall before the German tanks, which were going along this ring road, went past us with their aerials flapping with the pennants on top, and we managed to vanish before the armour got upon us. And the tanks went down the road, disappeared.
What sort of tanks they were?
I wouldn't like to say, I wouldn't know now. Perhaps they were Panthers, but I don't know. They weren't Tigers, certainly, because I don't recall seeing Tigers until in Northwest Europe, personally. Anyway, they went past, they were going quite quickly.
Were they closed down, or were they commanders?
Oh, commanders on top.
They heads out, were they?
Oh, yes, all three. There were three of them. And they're obviously changing position or moving or getting out of it, probably. But they were moving quite fast. I was surprised how quickly they were moving.
Rather a narrow escape.
Yes, at least for that private soldier. Anyway, we stayed there, some food came up, and then later on we were told to bed down there for the night, and we'd take Catania the next day. And then it's about 1 o'clock in the morning. The explosion started as the Germans destroyed their ammunition dump. And it was the biggest display of fireworks I think we've ever seen. Not very far away, a safe distance away, but a tremendous firework display. And it went on for hours. And they blew the dump up and everything else. And as a result, we knew that they had left Catania. So the next day we went through it, and that was that.
What sort of formation did you adopt then for approaching it?
Approaching what?
The town.
I don't.
Did you advance in tactical formation, or did you?
No, I don't think so. No, I didn't march in. We didn't. We didn't go down the main street sort of thing. But we tended to go down walls, along tracks, and so on, and usually one behind the other, single file. A number of single files going in that sort of way. But we weren't.
Files,
yes, okay. But we weren't in a sort of bayonet charge formation or anything like that.
Well, and when you were clearing this wood, presumably the idea was to search and scour the wood. What sort of formation were you?
Oh, I don't know what it's called. A line abreast, is it? Yeah. Long line of.
An extended skirmish line.
Yeah. And they were with, of course, bayonets fixed and all ready. And, yes, that was sort of general sweep through. And, of course, unless you're caught from the side, you're. Chances of casualties were reduced, having people strung out that way.
Well, you couldn't be enfiladed.
No. So that, yes, and that was Catania.
What happened to you when you got into the town?
Well, we just went straight through it. And out the other
side.
No. I don't think I went through the middle of the town. I think mine was going around the side, and we still went on up to the north, up this coastal road with the bridges on it. I think that's right, yes. Just remind myself if I've... Yes, I think the... I think really the firework display and everything was the end of the next day, the end of my first day.
You mentioned not enjoying being mortared. Do you think that the mortar was the most frightening weapon?
No. Overall, during the war, I think the most frightening weapon was the 88. The 88 anti-tank gun they used. I think that was the horror, because it was with you before you heard it so fast. And also, I didn't like the sound of the Schmeisser. Such a high rate of fire. It was zip, 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 noise as the very high rate of fire, and of course it meant that they were very near. The spando could be a long way off, but if people were using spandos, you were very close to them. So I think the two really, 88s and spandos, Schmeisers, the two.
And do you think that was a fairly common attitude that, you know, these two weapons were the most?
Yes, I think so. I think it was, looking back now to this, my part in this last war, I'm not conscious of being frightened of German rifles or German bayonets. I think we were far more nervous of coming up upon somebody with a Schmeisser or being hit with an 88 if it happened to be in a wagon.
Some soldiers have said the Germans didn't seem very keen on closing with the bayonet or on close quarter fighting. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, no. Overall, again, I was thinking, I never recall Germans making a bayonet charge, in that sense of the word. But I'm certainly conscious of them standing very still when you came. They didn't necessarily run away or get out of it. I think they were, the idea that the Germans don't like English cold steel and all that 1914 war theory, I'm not sure that applied at all. I think they were probably like ourselves.
And other people say that they didn't seem very keen on operating at night, that they preferred to operate in daylight.
The Germans?
The Germans, and that we were much, much better adapted to working at night. Did you find that to be?
No, certainly not. The Germans ran with patrols too, and their patrols tended to be much larger than ours. In other words, if you came across German patrol, it was probably 20 men. So we had the respect for them if they were moving about at night, and again jumping a bit and going to Normandy, they certainly used their tanks a lot at night, which we'd always been told is of course tanks can't fight at night. The Germans did, and at one particular page, I'll perhaps go into more detail later, they used to bring the tanks right up to more or less our lines, creeping them out, and suddenly opening up with everything, which was very alarming when you had an empty field in front of you and suddenly tank guns are going and the machine guns. It's very distracting.
Of course, in Normandy, they were labouring under the disadvantage of having an adverse situation in the air, weren't they?
So
they couldn't really move their armour in the daytime.
Well, they did that too. I saw plenty of tanks at night in the daytime.
But I think they preferred not to if they could avoid daylight.
Which tanks or?
Tanks, yes.
Well, I should think our tanks were the same. Mm. Our tanks didn't like going at night because they couldn't see anything, they were blind. But they were certainly, again, the Giel, they were certainly used at night. And as well as at the Parc de la Mer.
Mm. Well, I think we had more of an option of daylight operation because the German Air Force was very weak by the time of Normandy.
Well, yes, but the Germans were not. Again, you were probably far better informed than I am, but I don't remember any set piece tank attack by Germans. I've seen some of ours, but the Germans didn't. The Germans seemed to work their tanks in pairs or threes, and with covering fire to each other. That sort of thing. They use them as fire points, really, as much as anything, I think. And dealing with our tanks, because they had the 88 gun on them.
To return to the narrative, so you'd swept through Catania.
And then we started. Then we started, of course, going up to Messina. And the method of advance there was very strange. Well, not strange, but it's the only way. Because we had the hills on the left and the sea on the right. And the narrow road, which was, of course, an excellent killing area, along which we had to proceed. And the battalion moved up, the arrangement was that a section would go forward, led by an officer, And then his platoon would be following up on each side of the road in single file, well spaced. And the officer, in fact, would lead the way. And, of course, he was the man who was going to be shot if anybody was waiting, or he was going to tread on the mine or the tripwire. So this method of proceeding was very lonely, to say the least. And the commanding officer was very good at this. He made sure everybody took their turn. They were. It wasn't just a case of one company doing it. Perhaps one company would do it for a couple of hours and then another company would have a go, and on the basis of fairness, because whoever was out front was going to be killed if the Germans were there. We were encouraged to push on as fast as we could. We were conscious of the treading on mines. There were lots of S mines about. The Germans had put tank mines down too, the teller mines.
Must have been very difficult to keep moving if you were having to watch the ground carefully in front of your feet.
Well, yes. And looking to
looking
be
round as well.
Being shot at as well. I mean, looking for some movement of a curtain, perhaps an upstairs window in these towns. So for that reason, it was very nerve-wracking. And I remember very well, it was during the period I was doing a stint of this, that a vehicle drew up alongside. And it was a jeep with a driver and a signaller and a brigadier in a red hat. He was our brigadier. And I was terribly impressed because he greeted me with my Christian name, and he asked me if I felt as lonely as he did on these occasions. And he stayed with me for about 10 minutes, driving the jeep slowly by the side of me, and talking to me about all this and that. And I thought that was absolutely magnificent. I've always remembered all these years later that he'd no need to do that. But it was leading from the front in a big way. And the effect on everybody was, of course, super. But it was a very nerve-wracking job doing that.
How far ahead were you from the next man in the file then? What was the distance between?
Oh, a couple of yards. It wasn't a case of being, really
way
spread out. No.
And what sort of speed do you think you could maintain?
Walking speed. It was more than an amble. They were moving.
Presumably you couldn't move that fast because you were having to be so observant.
Yes, but I think you got a bit casual after a bit. And, only another 10 minutes and then somebody else is going to come and do this. I think there was a bit of that on. One of the things at that time, during that period, which we always noticed, was that we always got into the town to find the bridges blown. They always blew those bridges, and they always blew them before we got them. We had patrols out at night who would say the bridge was intact, and when we actually reached it, it had gone. Which, of course, they were all dried up wadis at that stage, although there was no water in the rivers, so we had to climb down and climb up the other side. The bridges and those bridge areas were very often used for ambush purposes. Another remarkable feature of that advance involved the towns and the villages. We went in there, and these were towns and villages were always deserted. There was nobody about at all, no cats, no dogs, nothing. An empty town with all the doors and shutters locked and fastened, so that it would not be possible for us to get into a building if anybody started shooting. Proceeded into the middle of the town, Town Hall Square or whatever it was, Market Square, and we knew quite well what was going to happen. As soon as we got into the Town Hall Square, the church bell would ring. And as soon as the church bell rang, the shelling started. And there was no doubt about it, somebody connected with the church or otherwise, because we didn't trust them, was signalling to the guns that we were there, or to the mortars. And they did it time after time. And we did everything we could to get to those churches. We sent people in to kind of shoot people or do anything else, or not, you know, go around a back road to try and get to the church before anybody went into the main square. We never succeeded. And every single time they did it. I think the only time we were successful at all, I was at all successful, was I did catch an Italian captain who was obviously an FOO, and he'd been in the church tower watching and so on, he had the guns, and we caught him, and that was that, so he surrendered all right. But that was the only time we had any success at all, and he was in other words, it was Italian guns that were...
They left him behind to
do the observing, and he hadn't managed to get out. He may not have wanted to get out of it, we don't know, but that was that.
Did you exchange any words with him when you caught him?
I don't know. I think the niceties between posing officers, the usual sort of pleasantries, and lots of sad business. We were fighting each other and so on. And he seemed he could speak English, but I don't remember anything important that he was to say. Now it's just a case of he was caught and that was that, and we were getting him back.
Presumably they had all these town squares registered, well registered, yeah, on
there. Oh, presumably. We would have done.
What sort of shelling was it? Was it...
Probably mortar. Yes, mortar and shell.
Mainly mortar.
Yes, and shells, because of course Italian guns there, but the Germans were there with the mortars too. I think it was both.
Was it... do you know if it was field artillery or heavier?
No, it would be field, wouldn't it? I think it would be field then.
Did you suffer a lot of casualties from this sort of...
No, because we were
bombardment.
No, because we were tended to be, get out of it if we could. Once we heard them coming, people didn't hesitate to run back away from the square. We had some casualties, but and of course we realised later that the townspeople were all in the houses anyway. They hadn't very often. They hadn't vacated the town.
Presumably, they'd be down in their cellars if they had.
Yeah. I mean, terrified poor people. They were in the meat in the sandwich. With this bridge business, blowing bridges and so on, I do remember a place, I think it was called Carlantini. I'm not sure now, but we had to stop at one of these bridges overnight. It was when we got to it, the daylight was going. And of course, it was all high summer this. So that dusk was quite late on. We'd settled down on the river bank, the Wadi bank, in position. We settled down, we had a meal, I remember, brought up. They were very good with the food. And middle of the night, there's some shooting on the other side of the river road. On the bridge, and nothing happened, just one burst, and that was that. And then subsequently, they in the day, moonlight or in the dusk or whatever it was, we saw somebody crawling along the road on the other side. So a wounded man. So we went down and got him, and it was one of our officers, and he'd been shot in the stomach and he died a short time later. But he'd been caught with a Schmeisser, and it was one of our patrols.
They'd gone out round exploring the bridge area, had they?
Somewhere higher up or lower down. We sometimes didn't know where they were, but they were our chaps. And I asked him, because I was concerned to let people know, while the stretcher bearers were being sent for, I asked him who he was. And I've never forgotten. He looked at me and he said, "Don't you know me? I'm Grey." And it was the officer who, one of the other officers who joined me, in the wig, we'd flown up together from Egypt, and he'd gone out on patrol and killed. But I always remember that with Grey and his distress that I hadn't recognised him, because, and of course I didn't recognise him, because his face was so contorted and ashen and all looked horrible. He was obviously in great pain. And that was the end of Grey. And I suppose that was the first friend, or friend, more or less a friend, that I lost in that sort of way. We didn't move on. We pulled him back, got him back across the river and sent him back to the RAP. And that one then moved on the next day. But I don't think there was anything else to remember there.
When you were subject to these bombardments, did you ever manage to get counter-battery support from friendly artillery?
Not there. Not in Sicily, I don't remember at all. There was not the tie-up that we had in Normandy. I suppose our own mortars would be somewhere around.
But you had battalion mortars, didn't you?
Oh, yes.
Did they actually reply to this?
Well, I don't know. They had different roles. On these business in the field, in the villages and towns and so on, that business in the town hall square, the mortars themselves would be on the move. They'd be dismounted and not available. The 6-pounder anti-tank guns would be no use. So really, I'm not conscious of any artillery support at that stage, because we were moving. We never became static again.
But you mentioned earlier on you know you were expecting the priests to move up when you were outside Catania.
Yes.
And did they actually turn up in the end, or?
They came later, but we stopped them. But I mean, we never saw them again. I never saw them firing or anything like that. And they'd be part of the big plan, I suppose. Don't know what their role was.
And what about armour? Did you ever have any tanks in support during the St. Farms?
I don't remember any tanks at all. I don't remember seeing a tank in Sicily.
Apart from the German ones?
Apart from the German ones and apart from armoured cars. We had armoured cars. I think it was the Inzo Court Regiment. And they were there, and they were moving up and down with us. I think they were reconnaissance, really. But
they would be light armoured reconnaissance.
Yes. Oh, that was it. Well, yes, I saw those. I remember it particularly well because there was one officer who was there and who used to amuse us all by stopping his armoured car and shouting down to us that we want to get up there and get a crack at the Hun, which was we found rather amusing because we were saying the same thing to him. You go on. But yes, that there was that armour, but I don't remember any other.
Did you see anything of the Royal Air Force or the American Air Force?
Again, I'm not conscious of it. I'm not conscious of any kind of bombing or anything like that to help us forward. Nothing like that. There may have been the odd dogfight up in the air, but nothing else.
And what about hostile aircraft? Were you conscious of an air threat to your...
No. Advice? No. Never bombed, nothing happened to them. So. But
and did the Germans ever mount any strong rearguard action during this advance up the road?
No.
They were just delaying you by demolition and mining.
And the
shelling and mortaring.
Yes, and the odd ambush. You know, that I came across... I went in one place on a patrol on the other side of a blown bridge. And it was unusual, that was on the hillside or the side of the river. And it was quite a deep, steep bank. There was a row of houses on top. And the houses on the hillside, the back door was down at the bottom in the cellar. And the front door on the road was up in the attic, you see. And I had about 4 or 5 chaps on this patrol with me. And we went up to the top of the house to get out onto the main road where the bridge had been blown, and they couldn't get this door open. This has got a bar across it to get out into the road, and eventually we kicked it and broke it open, and I stepped out into the roadway, and I looked towards the bridge and there was nothing there. And then I turned the other way. And there were three of the most enormous Germans that I had ever seen at this length of time. I mustn't exaggerate, but I'm sure that not one of them was less than about 7 feet tall. They were huge and very close. And I looked at him and them for long enough to see him getting his Schmeisser off his shoulder when I decided that this was not a sensible confrontation. And I ran out of the house, or out of the room, and the men by that time were shouted to them, get out of it. And one of them, I think it was Arthur Atkinson actually, one of them left a grenade behind. And I got lost on the way down. I couldn't find the way out, and I finished out on...